Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Radio Z Hour, an interactive talk show celebrating the written word. Presented by the Zahme Publishing Press, www.zahme.com. That's ZHARMAE.com.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's Sunday, December 6th. It's 4 p.m. here on the Pacific, 7 p.m. On the East Coast, and a bit later in London. Today we've got a very, very special guest, Madeline Vaughn, who's the author of Sons of Thespian on, and we're really excited to have her. Really quick
hi.
Before the... Hi, Madeline, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Oh, I am fantastic. What time is it in London right now?
It is 12 o'clock at night.
Oh, my
dedication.
Goodness. Yeah, I love the dedication. It's nice and late there, and happy to have you on the show.
Very happy to be here, thanks.
Oh, fantastic. Really quickly, before we get into everything, I just want to let everybody know, if you guys have any questions or comments you guys want to call in, the number is 347-996-3900. And myself and Madeline would be happy to answer any questions that come up for you as you're listening in. Don't forget to check out Blog Z. It's zahmeblog.wordpress.com. We've got lots of new upcoming posts pretty much 3 days a week, roundups every week. So pretty exciting stuff. Don't hesitate to check out First Reads First as well. And it's a really awesome place to read through the work, check it out, make a decision if you like it or not, and then, of course, you can buy it wherever you like to buy your books. also, really, really exciting, Zahme turns 5 years old next Sunday on the 13th of December. Yeah! Isn't that exciting?
It is very exciting.
Yeah. Very exciting. Well, Madeline, tell us a little bit about yourself. I know you've been on the show a few times, but tell listeners something they... don't already know. What do we not know about you?
Oh gosh, I talk a lot, so they probably know everything about me. Hi, so I'm Madeline Vaughn. I am half English, half French. I live in Winchester in the UK, and yeah, I am currently undertaking a PhD at the University of Winchester, which is looking at the evolution of fairies in mythology and literature. So there you go. That's something new.
That is very new. I actually didn't even know that about you. So tell me, how did you get into the? How does one get into fairy mythology as a PhD? How did that route get you there?
Well, to begin with, I've always been a big mythology nut, and I love old stories. I traveled a lot when I was little, and I got into fairies properly when I was quite young. I was really into flower fairies, and then it took a darker route as I started to look into the original fairies, especially in Irish mythology. And it happened that my mother asked me to write something nice for her one day. She's like, "Why can't you ever write anything nice? Why can't you write a story about, you know, fairies or something?" So I looked into original fairies, and they're man-eating monsters. So I thought, yeah, I can write about those. That works for me. And that, from there, basically, I fell in love with the stories. I fell in love with the mythos and the idea. And I'm a bit of a history buff as well. I'm not good at it, but I enjoy it. So that aspect came into it as well. And, yeah, I just suddenly thought... When they said, "Why don't you do a PhD?" I thought, yeah, that'd be great. Actually, I'd really love to be a lecturer one day. I'd love to teach. And they said, "What do you want to be an expert in?" And I just thought, you know what? Fairies, because why not? If you're going to be an expert in anything, it might as well be fairies. So that's
fair
how
enough.
I got here.
Wow. So, I mean, are fairies something you say are kind of like a hallmark for you in your writing?
Not necessarily, because it's always, okay, this isn't quite related, but it's when I hate chemistry. I'm really bad at science. But one time I was writing a story, and for it, one of the characters could use alchemy. And for that, I put in hours and hours of research into making sure it made sense. So there was a lot of chemistry involved. And then I posted the story up and someone messaged me saying, wow, are you a chemistry major? This is really smart chemistry. And I'm like, I'm barely even passing my exams. You know, I'm barely scraping through. So it wasn't, at that point, it wasn't homework because I wanted it to work out and I wanted it to make sense. So when I'm writing fairies, it's not homework. It's just a delight, I guess. I really, really enjoy
right.
it.
Okay. So now tell us a little bit more about Sons of Festian. I know it's your first book that's been out, and it's been out for a little while. How's everything going with that?
It's going really, really well. Well, I've been counted as one of the Zave best sellers for the last few months, which has been very exciting. I've been working on the next book, which is currently being edited. I'm starting to see, because I thought what would happen would be in the first few months, I would see most of the activity and then things would sort of go down. But actually in recent months, things have picked up again. And I'm seeing people talking about it online, people I don't know, and it's getting a little bit further afield, which is incredibly exciting for me. And I'm seeing some fan works and even some fan fiction, which I'm not reading, but I'm seeing it and eyeing it and smiling to myself. So it's going very, very well. And I'm really enjoying it. And I've been working on the third book. And I'm amazed by the response that I've gotten and very excited by the response I'm going to get when I release the second book.
I'm excited for it. I mean, fan fiction is kind of like the hallmark of, you know, almost like every author's like wet dream in some cases, knowing that they love your work so much that they felt the need to rewrite it in their own little work.
It's the highest form of flattery. I know some people don't like fan fiction. I've seen authors say how much they don't like it and they don't want to see it. But I just think it's incredible because people have been so captured by what you've done. So they've fallen so in love with these characters that they want to, you know, do something more with them. They want to see more from them. I just think that's brilliant. It's the highest form of flattery. It really is. So, you know, absolutely. If anyone is listening and they want to write fan fiction, now is your chance. You absolutely have my permission to write fan fiction.
Do you think that the fan fiction kind of might spur you to write like little interim short stories about any of your characters or little short adventures to kind of hide people over between books?
Yes. I'm not ashamed. I'm a little bit ashamed. I have also written fan fiction for my own work, where I've just suddenly thought...
That's awesome.
I've done it, and I've taken characters who are not together in the books, and I've just thought, you know what, they'd be a great couple if I just put them in a different circumstance. And I have done that, and I've done it shamelessly. And I think there's a power, there's a freedom in that, because I can turn around and say, this is non-canon. But it gives me the chance to explore other aspects of the characters, which I couldn't because the plot just doesn't let that side of them come out.
Right.
And it has also encouraged me to write a few short stories, and maybe something will come of that a little bit later on, but we'll see.
Perhaps some origin stories for some of these characters?
Yeah. And I heard one of these, I used to be of the firm belief that prequels were nonsense, because if the prequel was good enough, it would be the original story. But now I'm starting to think I wouldn't mind actually writing a prequel, because I've got all these characters who've developed who are from the older generation, and I want to show them their story.
Right. Sometimes they kind of you get to a point as you're writing the characters that they become real people in a sense, and you want to just kind of explore who they are and what they've done and what they've accomplished and kind of where they've gotten.
Yeah. I'm sorry, can you repeat that, please? Again, I'm sorry, I'm getting extremely flushed because I'm embarrassed.
No, don't be embarrassed. You know, we wouldn't push it out there if it wasn't good work. And no need to be embarrassed. I think it's fantastic, actually, that the response has been strong enough that you're looking at how better to connect the additional characters.
And I think that when you're writing something and when you've been writing it over a large period of time, the characters grow with you. And when it's a series, things change. And characters who were literally just created to be kind of background, they were just set, they were non-NPCs, non-playable characters that were just in the background to get your main character from A to B. And suddenly they develop a kind of sentience of their own. You think about them and you want to do more with them.
Is there any type of aspect of the characters that you think we're going to see more of, or something different that might not be expected as we go into book two?
We're going to see a lot more of Arlen Zachary, who is kind of the antagonist in the first book. Oddly enough, depending which is your favorite character, either Rufus or Yonat, you'll either really, really sort of not mind Zachary or you'll totally loathe him. But in the second book, you get a lot of things from his perspective because you needed a narrative to show what was happening in two different places. And you suddenly start to understand the kind of person he is. And I think people will be surprised. Of the few people who've read the second book so far, with the editing, a few of them really didn't like him. And by the end, they've expressed a complete change of heart. So I think that people will find themselves reevaluating what they thought about certain characters. So, yeah.
And, I mean, was that something you were aiming to have happen, or is just kind of something that developed out of the plot of the work?
It developed. I wrote the first book when I was 17, and as I was writing the second one, and in the first book, he just used to be an absolute villain. And then as I was writing the second one, I suddenly realized I need another perspective to show what's happening in Hamartia at the moment, and Zachary was the most obvious choice. As I started writing from his viewpoint, I started thinking, what motivates this person? Why is he doing what he is? And I suddenly uncovered a very complex aspect of his character, which I hadn't anticipated. And as I uncovered that, I had to go back and rewrite the first book to show some of his motivations a little bit more. So it wasn't planned. No, he surprised me. I was also one of these people who got to book two and had to reevaluate who I thought this antagonist was. And he's not an antagonist. He's actually a hero who's trying his absolute best to appear like a bad guy, but he fails like 89% of the time. So, yeah.
What for you was the most difficult part about the writing process with, regards to the development of the world or development of any one particular character?
Writing from Jonathan's point of view in the first book was a little bit difficult because he was based a little bit off of my brother. And this is the first time I've ever tried to write someone based off a real human being. And in the end, I just had to change large aspects of Jonathan because I couldn't base him off my brother, Jonathan. So that was quite difficult to begin with. And I think the other thing is that as much as I love fantasy, I'm a little bit afraid of high fantasy, which is odd because I then decided to write high fantasy.
What kind of makes you fearful of it?
The world building. I get very overwhelmed when I'm reading something and you've got pages and pages that describe the world and you have to learn so much in a very short amount of time. And so when I was writing, I was very conscious of the fact that first and foremost, I had to I had to have the characters. They needed to be the focus, not the world. And the world, I needed to introduce the world slowly over time. And that was quite tough because the temptation is just to get it all out in one chapter. And you can't. You have to pace it, but you have to pace it in a way that makes sense. And that was a bit of a logistical nightmare, I think. That was probably the hardest part, that and the editing and the re-editing and the re-editing after that.
Yeah, well, that's par for the course. Sorry, getting your work out. Okay. And so, I mean, as we kind of get into book two, because I think we're it's looking to be released here mid-year 2016. Is that kind of what we're looking for?
I'm thinking it'll probably appear sort of spring, toward the end of spring, going into summer, I think, is around the time. So around the time that the first book came out, which I'm happy with. It's a very long book. It was exceptionally long, and I cut it down, so it's just a little bit longer than the first book. So I think people are going to be pleased.
The first book, and I actually have it in my hand, is fairly, fairly thick. It's, almost 550 pages, almost.
It's over 160,000 words, so it's pretty hefty, yeah.
What is it like to write that much? I mean, to kind of be so immersed in that world for so long. I kind of approach this, understanding a lot of authors have a tendency to kind of stick around, maybe 60, 70, 80,000 words. You've got like two books here.
Yeah, I struggle to write short things, actually. It's much easier for me to write very, very long things than it is for me to write short, and I don't know why. I think the shortest book I've ever written is just over 100,000 words. It's a genuine problem for me. I guess I can excuse it because it's epic fantasy, and epic fantasy is pretty hefty. I mean, it's hefty, but it's not George R. R. Martin hefty. So, I can take solace in that.
Yeah. And, I mean, for the reader, what would you say is the main takeaway you're wanting them to kind of come from the book with?
That's a kind of a hard question because I think that depending on who you are and what stage of life you're going through, you're going to take away different things from it. And there are several themes that run through the book. On the one aspect, there's a very clear theme, which is that running away from your problems never works out. You can't escape your problems. You have to face them eventually. But there's also a lot of themes about loss of various kinds and about bereavement. And it's a young adult, which tends to be quite romance heavy at the moment. The genre is quite romance heavy, and they have a lot of sort of love triangles. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to focus on friendship before anything else. And the power of love, of that kind of love and familial love. So that's probably also something else that I would want people to take away. I'd want them to take away these strong feelings of camaraderie, I guess. I'd want them to feel like they were part of the adventure themselves, that they know these characters, that they're friends with them. So, yeah.
And was that kind of difficult for you to kind of convey in the writing? Or do you feel like there's, was there like significant type of growth that you had to do to accomplish that effectively?
With regards to the friendship thing, no, because I was writing this humongous story when I was quite stressed. I was going through my exams when I first wrote it. And there were aspects of my friendships with other people and aspects of me. And so these characters became very familiar to me. And as I was writing them, I felt a great friendship with them. I feel very strongly about them. They are friends of a sort. I spent so much time with them, you know, when I was writing them, when I was thinking about them, they were almost real. They were tangible. And
right.
So conveying that, at least I hope, was actually kind of easy. And the conveying the things about loss was also easy, because I think that as humans, one of the best ways that we can sort through our own grief, our own emotions, and our thoughts is to put them out in an art form. So painting, music, writing, poetry, things like that. There, we have a whole history of expressing our fears and our losses in very beautiful ways. And I hope I've succeeded in that. I hope elegant rather than crude, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah. Looks like we have a caller. Caller, hi.
Hi, it's Jules, J-A Ironside.
Hi, hey, how are you, Jules? How are you doing?
Yeah, great. It's, I hadn't planned on calling in, but it sounded like you're having an interesting conversation.
Yeah, we've just been kind of wandering through the book, Sons of Bastien, and the next one on the list to come out here, I guess, another 5-6 months. Did you have, what were you looking to add into the conversation?
Well, Jules has actually read the second book.
Yeah.
Has she?
Yes.
What are your thoughts on it so far?
On the whole series, or just in general? I really enjoyed the first book, and I liked the second book even better. I don't want to give anything away, but the character story arc in a really, really interesting way. I was actually sat there at one point cursing Madeline for what she was doing with the characters, particularly my favourite characters. And she might have got a few rude messages from me at certain points while I was reading the second book.
Oh, goodness.
I take that as a victory.
Yeah.
You know, that's fantastic. You know, that actually kind of walks us really nicely into the main topic for the show, which was actually, you know, about creating emotion through dialogue. I guess the biggest question, you know, would be, how effectively do you think that's done in this series or in general?
I think. Oh, sorry. Do you this one?
I'm pretty sure the question was directed at you. I was just going to put in that dialogue is my favorite thing ever. So be kind, Jules. Be kind.
Actually, and I think there's, because of this unique world, there's a unique voice that goes with it. All the characters sound like themselves. They don't sound like one person putting on lots of different hats, as it were. So I think it's created quite effective. One of the faults.
And so, I mean, how important is it for you, you know, as you're kind of crafting, you know, a character and what they're saying and how they're interpreting situation? I mean, do you walk into it with a type of emotion you're attempting to convey and then work from there, or do you kind of let the scenes develop kind of organically and you kind of just feel out the character and what they would be likely to say? I mean, how do you approach that?
Well, I go in with an idea of where I want the end of the conversation to go, the kind of mood that needs to be set, how the characters need to feel. But then I do let it become quite organic. Sometimes I may have a couple of lines that I need to get in, but for the most part I let it run, because I feel that that's the best way to get a very real sounding conversation. And I surprise myself sometimes, because I run these conversations like they're actually happening, and the amount of times my boyfriend has walked in on me saying, "Who the hell are you talking to?" And I'm like, "Shut up, this is a very intense conversation. I do sort of talk as if kind of sort of Sméagol Gollum-esque a little bit. It's disconcerting to get these emotions out. And I think I spend the most time on dialogue than I do on anything else, because I think that dialogue is incredibly important. When we consider how we as non-fictional people, as real people, convey almost everything, you know, there's a lot to do with body language, but all information pretty much is gotten through words. So there's no narrator, there's no better narrator than what a person says and then how they act around what they've said. So it is the most important part of writing, I feel, for my style. So I do spend a lot of time on it, and I'm repeating myself, I'm sorry.
Do you think that there's any type of situation or emotion that you try to convey that tends to be more difficult than others, perhaps love or sense of awkwardness or fear, that just tends to be more difficult to convey effectively?
I think sometimes sadness is quite difficult to convey, because sadness and fear are sometimes best conveyed with silence. So it's kind of hard to write dialogue when the most sensible thing would be for them not to be talking at all, but you need them to be talking. That's probably the hardest, is when emotions get extremely high. And I guess also scenes when they're confessing love can so easily be tipped into something cheesy. So you need to find a balance between making it sound genuine and not cold, whilst also not making it sound like something you might see on the Disney Channel.
Right.
Not that there's anything wrong with Disney.
But you've said, or in some ways, what is more important than what is said, so that you can tell that it's not actually spelled out for the reader.
I can imagine that would be very difficult to kind of convey, you know, is those types of situations where there's not very much said. And I think when you have less being said, it becomes more important, particularly what is said. Do you think that you guys have a similar experience or different experience with that?
I think you've got to really earn the big speeches. I think you've probably got a little bit more leeway with epic fantasy in some respect. I'm doing paranormal mystery, so I need to keep my blog really quite short, because otherwise I'm trying to build up.
I think you helped yourself a little bit, Jules, with that, because you gave your main character a stutter, so it kind of stops you from writing epic speeches, doesn't it?
Main character who doesn't really speak very much at all.
it kind of helps. If you find yourself writing three paragraphs of someone stuttering, you probably go, hold on a second, is this something that she'd be saying? Whereas I do have characters who do quite enjoy a good little speech or two. Again, it's epic fantasy, so you can get away with it. But there's nothing I like more than doing the Joss Whedon-esque thing where someone gives a valiant, you know, a very deep-hearted speech, and then someone at the end goes, yeah, cool story, bro, something like that, and just dismisses it entirely.
But it's like, as long as it's earned, it's okay. So, you know, as long as the speech is not like a really long, epic speech, then that's okay. Yeah. When you come to one that's really epic, it has a lot of impact.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, my character and her speech impediment, the fact is when she finally does say a lot in one go, usually she is so completely pissed off by that point that she's almost earned the right to have somebody listen to her through what she needs to say, because she has to get it out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, Jules, because, like, I do epic speeches, you know, all the time, just myself. That's the average day for me. So I don't know what you're talking about, just having to earn it. Just, like, over breakfast, man, like, over cereal. That's me. But, no, I get what you mean. You're more likely to capture the reader's attention, just like you're more likely to capture a person's attention if you have saved that up for the right moment. And it's difficult to save it up sometimes because, as you can notice, I do like to talk.
Yeah. So, you know, when you guys are, like, planning out your chapter or a scene or even an entire book, I mean, do you guys kind of run it fairly organically? You just kind of start typing and kind of as it comes along? Or, I mean, are you planning it out chapter by chapter, paragraph by paragraph, and perhaps even placing important scenes here and there in the book and kind of tacking on, you know, the emotional takeaway with that?
I think we're both, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Jules, but I think we both walk into it with an idea of where we're going, but we always leave room for a little bit of organic growth, don't we?
I've usually got a rough plan, but there's, in some ways, there's nothing better than a scene, and the character actually surprises you by going in a direction slightly different or completely different than what you were expecting. It can be quite unsettling at times as well, but you usually find out that the character's right and perhaps the direction you were trying to push it in was actually wrong.
Yeah, I think the problem is that sometimes if you plan too meticulously and you know just, and you suddenly find yourself struggling to write that scene, it might be because actually subconsciously you understand how everything is developed, and what you originally planned may not be right for what your character is doing now, and you can be surprised by it, and they do jump up and do their own thing sometimes, and more often than not it's for the better, and you should just let them do what they need to do.
Yeah, too much planning and you end up vulnerability. That's where a lot of writer's block comes from, thinking that you absolutely have to get to from point A to point Z through all the other levels in order. Not necessarily always the case.
I think you end up regretting it. What was it? J.K. Rowling wrote the last chapter of Harry Potter very early on and has since expressed that she wishes she hadn't done it the way that she did. And I think that's an example of someone who... Of extremely advanced planning, which she felt was no longer correct for what she was trying to do by the time she got there. I don't necessarily agree, but hey ho. So yeah, I think you always need to be fluid, a little bit fluid. There are certain things that you're going to want to try and stick to, because otherwise you might suddenly find your ending changing dramatically, which could be awkward for everybody involved. But, yeah, leave some breathing room. Let your babies fly a little bit.
Okay. Really quickly, everybody, if you guys are listening in, feel free to call in, ask questions, comments, 347-996-3900. We're all happy to chit-chat and say hi. Back to kind of where we're going, my another kind of question that tends to come up a lot with new authors, you know, is once you've written this work, it's your opus, it's very personal, you know, when you're going into the editing process, I mean, what's kind of going through your mind? Or if you are asked to, say, completely rewrite, in some cases, an entire scene or entire chapter, how do you approach that?
Usually the editor's right. You can't always think. Usually they ask you to rewrite something completely. With my first book, I Belong to the Earth, I had a very particular line that I thought the book should start with. and my editor actually said, I need you to take this back about half a chapter. And I, at the time, I was sort of thinking, well, that's not going to work. That's going to take away the impact. But actually, she was right, because I'd done someone right the action before they even had a chance to care about the characters. And it worked.
And what about you, Jules?
That was Jules.
Sorry.
Oh. It's the British accent, isn't it?
Yeah, it's two English people.
It is. But it's because you're both such lovely girls that I have such difficulty telling them apart.
Good save.
Yeah, smooth. Okay. Maybe Jules, we should announce ourselves before we start speaking for the sake of everybody. You know, like we're reading a script.
Oh my God, this is
Madeline. Hi. Editing is amazing and also the bane of my existence. And as Jules said, the editor is pretty much always right. And I've obviously sent at least the Blood of the Delphi to several people to edit before actually sending it in to Zame. And that's included Jules and my friend Amelia, who's also a writer. And there is a kind of, if you've spent that long on something and then someone turns around and goes, nah, chop it off, get rid of this entire chapter, you do die a little inside. And I think actually when I started out, it was much harder to listen to editing advice. And it took me a few years really to be able to get over myself a little bit, I guess. To accept that, yeah, actually, just because everything sounds right entirely in my head, when you're editing something, you have to step out of your own skin and you have to look at it from a completely different kind of eye, because the people who are reading it are not going to be you. If it was just going to be you reading it, then you wouldn't be publishing it. So you do need to try and sort of distance yourself, which is incredibly difficult at times. And that's why editors are so valuable and so incredible. You know, I've got a great editor with Zame, who's Olga, and they're amazing because they basically do that very difficult thing for you. And most of the time they break it to you quite gently, which is very appreciative. You know, it's slowly massage the ego, like, yes, this bit is very nice, but I feel like you, with your amazing talents, could do this even better. And, you know, you realize only halfway through the rewrite, hold on, they're telling me this is terrible. That's what they're actually saying. But somehow they've made it sound nice.
They're much better than I am if I'm editing somebody's work. I tend to steamroll right on through everything, so I it's always nice to hear when they're very nice about it, because I'll just say, no. This isn't going to work. Let's change it. Rewrite it. This is crap. And but as you'll notice, I very rarely will edit work because of that.
I'm slightly relieved. You just find me weeping in a corner.
You know, I occasionally will edit work, and I tend to be very – I do try to be gentle about it, but I usually don't have enough time to really focus on being gentle. So I think the last time I edited anybody's work was maybe 4 years ago. And very thankful that my very first authors that we signed have very, very, very thick skins, because they would not still be with us if that was not the case.
This is the first time you give critique, though. I mean, the first time I really gave someone critique, I sort of went in a bit like a bull in a china shop, and and you really thought about it afterwards, and the person was okay, I'd like to point out. I was really embarrassed that I'd gone in that way, because it's been so thoughtless. Because I got really caught up in what I thought it should be like, and it's getting the balance between being honest and being respectful, I think.
I had a great story. My friend Amelia, aforementioned Amelia, was a master student who was doing creative writing at the university, and the class was made up basically of a lot of the creative writing graduates and then several new people who'd come into it. And she described how during the workshopping, the new people who hadn't basically gone through 3 years of brutal workshopping were being extremely nice, really sort of, yeah, no, that works great, that works fine. And then it got round to all of the veteran creative writing students, and they would just rip things to shreds. And then afterwards, they would go up to these slightly shell-shocked sort of newcomers and be like, I'm sorry, that's just, you're just going to have to get used to it. It's no offense, but we want you to do the best that you can. And it's brutal, but the thing is that you do need to kind of accept that when people are critiquing you, even though it feels like, rather, when they're critiquing your work, even though it feels like they're taking a jab at you, they're not, because actually most of the time, if someone has gone in and said, no, this is terrible, this needs to be changed, it means that they're actually bothering, so that they think it's worth it. Because I know that we've been in situations where you've read something and you've been like, yeah, it's fine, because you don't have the energy to be able to even begin to explain where you could restart. You go, right, that's just at that level, there's nothing I can do. Whereas if you get a piece of work which shows massive potential, which you think, oh, this could be incredible, you just need to change this, this, and this, yeah, you're going to be brutal because you want the best out of them, so you push them. So I guess we shouldn't criticize you for being mean, even though you're not mean, but yeah.
I'm not usually mean, but I think sometimes having to come in after, maybe miscommunication between an editor and an author and saying, you know what, hey, this really isn't working, and kind of being very blunt about it, puts a different perspective on what's being asked of an author versus just, well, we could maybe do better.
Yeah.
We have another caller who's on. Hello, caller. How are you?
Sorry, hello?
Hi.
Oh, sorry. I didn't know this was a call as such. I thought it was just a different type of radio service. Hello.
Yeah, well, you've been on for a couple minutes. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Fantastic. You're actually on the air with Radio Z. We have a couple of authors on with us. Did you have any questions for us?
Yes. Does it have to be on topic about the critiquing thing, or can it be a general question?
Sure. Either's fine.
Well, just to Madeline. Hi.
Hi.
I was just wondering about, obviously, in your second book, Birds of the Delphi, we will learn some aspects about characters that we didn't know before. Mm-hmm. When writing your first book, was there stuff that you really wanted to put in because it would help us understand a character, but you thought that, no, I need to keep this, you know, back until a certain point in the story?
Yes, actually. There were several moments where, when I was rewriting it, I wanted to add quite a lot of scenes. And I did add several scenes with Zachary in particular. And there were more that I did want to add. And I had to hold myself back because there needed to be room for that growth. There needed to be the temperature of the story, the way it needed to go. I couldn't include those details there because his part, he didn't have a part in that aspect of it yet. So, yeah, absolutely. I did have to take things out. And I actually wrote scenes, which I then completely removed, entire sections of the book, which I then had to sort of recreate in the second book in order to make sense. Good question. Thank you.
Thanks.
Sorry, that's all I wanted to ask.
Hello?
Hello? So, yeah, that's just what I wanted to ask.
Oh.
Thank you for asking.
Thank God.
Thank you so much for calling in.
Okay, sorry, I haven't called into radio shows before. Do I just hang up now? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Thank you for your time. Bye.
Bye.
So, Wow, that's fantastic. We love whip callers. You didn't happen to know that individual, did you, Madeline?
Absolutely not.
He's probably one of the people that's gonna just fall in love and start writing fan fiction after he gets a hold of the second book.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be if that person whom I do not know would like to do that, I would be 100% behind them doing that.
That's fantastic. So, wow, that's fantastic. Again, guys, if anybody wants to call in, ask questions, say hi to Madeline or to Jules, feel free to do so. The number is +1-347-996-3900. We'd love to chat with you guys. And, of course, I think we're all available on Twitter if you want to say hi and tweet us as we're on the show. So, Jules, you know, I have a copy of your book as well on my bookshelf. Can you tell us a little bit about you know, I Belong to the Earth? I know that you've been on the show as well before, you know, I think probably one of the fun questions I'd like to ask, you know, that I was already asked Madeline is, was there anything new that we don't know about you that would be interesting to know?
Anything new about me at all?
Yeah.
My autobiography that you already know, I'm a martial artist. I like collecting dead languages.
Okay, you said dead languages.
Dead languages. At the moment,
How did you get into being interested in dead languages?
I'm not entirely sure, actually. I think it's I did a bit of Latin at school, and my grandmother alive taught me some Gaelic, mm-hmm. my Irish, and it in general from there. I won't, but I know a few, or I know bits of a few. And it was fairly close to what would have been spoken in southern England in the Iron Age, which we don't actually have any. There were a few cursed tablets with bad ideas.
Right.
So the nearest, the closest language is a sort of form of Cornish, which would have been about used at the same sort of time. Yeah. The bit I've used, and I've not used very much, is probably modern, but it gives enough of a flavour of it. So I've actually been learning a bit of Cornish. It's quite similar.
So does this love of languages kind of translate into the books? Do you start, do you, or have you created any languages that you kind of include in your writing?
No, I'm not quite Tolkien level of linguistics.
So not creating any languages like J.R. Tolkien yet? Not
no.
quite there yet? Oh, okay. And so, to the main topic at hand, for you, what would you say was the most difficult or the most satisfying even, scene that you think you've written so far in the book? And, how was that in terms of kind of conveying the emotion and the impact that you were looking to get across?
In the first book, I think it would be the big reveal when you find out actually who is responsible. I won't go any further than that in case there's anyone who wants to read it and hasn't read it yet. So don't
go and read it. It's amazing.
That bit away. But
it is actually quite a fantastic book. That's fantastic. And how difficult was it for you to produce that particular, scene?
It was. This is complete fluke. I'll probably never do this again in my life, but I'd written 3/4 of the book, and one afternoon I sat down at 12 o'clock and at 9:30 I finished writing the book. And up until that point, I didn't know who'd done it, basically. I didn't know who the culprit was. I'd written that. So I wrote
No, I've known a lot of authors who tend to say they know who did it and they know how it happened and they know the entire work. And then there's others who kind of, you know, like you suggested, kind of go with the flow and you kind of find out who did it as you go as well. Do you usually go forward when you're writing work kind of unsure of what the end result is or who the culprit is? Or do you usually kind of plan out who it is and what they're about?
Well, I had a plan of how it was going to end. But initially, I thought the person who was going to be, you know, the culprit, as it were, was actually going to be somebody else. And when I wrote it out, it wasn't like that. And I realized looking back at it that on some level, I must have all along that it wasn't going to be that person. It was going to be somebody else because the amount of foreshadowing I'd put in the book all the way through that it was going to be this person that was there once you looked back on it. Made it possible to be anybody else, but I honestly didn't know on any sort of conscious level it was going to be that person. So generally, yes, I plan and I know exactly who it's going to be, but in this instance, it was a bit of a fluke. And
it shows you the level of sort of plot twist, the level of plot twist that it was a plot twist for the author. That's the level of plot twist we should all aspire to. The moment the author goes, what?
I recommend writing 25,000 words in one go. I wasn't fit for very much after that.
I love that. I love that. Plot twist for the author writing it. And, you know, for you, what do you think was the most difficult aspect of getting it done?
Sorry, what was the most...
What was the most difficult aspect of kind of getting the work done? Getting it completed and ready to go?
Well, actually, writing it wasn't difficult at all for the first book. Second book has been really, really difficult. I think because I've said myself, probably. But I've now finished the book, which is good. But the difficult bit was editing after the first draft. So it was sort of getting it right. And that's before an editor ever saw it. So I rewrote it about 7 or 8 times. So I would say the editing stage was actually the most difficult for me.
Okay.
Dedication.
Okay. Yeah. And I know I don't get the opportunity to ask a lot of people all the time, but what do you guys think of your covers? How about that process for you guys?
Oh, I love mine. I think that Peter, who did it, is just incredible. And he's supposedly, Hope is going to be doing the cover for the second book, which I'm very, very excited about. And I think the reason I really like my cover was that it has a very movie-esque kind of feel to it. Right now, you often get, with fantasy books, you can expect to see either they've got a crest on the front, or they've got someone in a cloak looking over their shoulder, looking sort of mildly surprised / angry, which is the sort of the typical fantasy figure, whereas this one, it looks like the cast of a movie poster with the characters across the front, and then you've got the crest and the title. And I think that it was a very unique idea, and I think that that's what's made it stand up. I'm also speaking as a big fan of Jules's book. I really, really like the front cover on hers. And I think, Jules, you were surprised by it, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I love it because it just, Emily, my editor, asked me for ideas and things I was coming up with. They felt quite trite to me, but I really couldn't think of anything. And then the artist, that was something they'd suggested, and I was like, oh my God, why didn't I? That's like the key pivotal moment where you meet. If there's one line that summed up everything in the book, it's in that particular scene, and somehow the artist rode in on it. It was perfect. I loved it. I thought it was really unfair.
Yeah, Jonathan did a fantastic job on your book, Jules. Truly one of our better covers. I'm really excited about what is in store for us next for the book. I hope you guys are.
Yep.
Well, I think that's about it for us for the day. If you guys would like to kind of let people know where they can learn more about you and better connect with you, start with you, Jules.
Yeah.
Jules, are you there?
And I'm also on Facebook, and you can follow me at J_AnnIronside on Twitter, and everything's sort of linked up, so you can find me quite easily from there.
Fantastic. Madeline?
I'm on Tumblr under mevaughn.tumblr. You can also find me on Facebook under madeline.e.vaughn. Alternatively, you can check out my website, madelinevaughn.com, or better yet, you can check out the book website, hamashiacycle.com. Basically, if you Google my name or my initials, you'll probably find something. And if you sort of see a gawkish kind of pasty person with curly hair, that's me, probably. So you can just follow me on that. And it's the same handle for Twitter and Instagram, too. So, yeah, look me up, and I will hopefully see you guys there. I've just released the first chapter of The Sons of Thestian as an audio file, if anyone is interested in the book and would like to have it read to them by me, by my luscious, docile tones, which I'm sure would definitely endear you to the book, she said skeptically. So that's on there as well. And you can find updates, comics, reblogs of fan works. I've also got Jules on my Tumblr a lot as well. We reblog each other quite a bit. So you can find her through me as well. So, yeah. Look forward to seeing you.
Fantastic. Madeline, Jules, it was a pleasure having you guys on the show today. Thank you so much for joining me today. It was a pleasure. It really was quite a pleasure. Guys, remember, if you would like to learn a bit more about Jules or Madeline, don't hesitate to check them out on social media. Obviously, you can search them out on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever you like to get your books from, perhaps Waterstones. And we look forward to seeing you guys next week. Have a fantastic rest
of your
day.
Thanks very much.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.